Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 71 of season 10 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again this season is Alan Sanders of The Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back to the show once again, Alan.
Thank you so very much. You know what? I'm sure you've got others who have had the distinct pleasure of saying they've been part of every one of your seasons, but I know I get to say that, and it feels really good. So thank you for having me back.
All right. Well, you know, just keep up what you've been doing up until now, and I'll keep having you back.
The fact that you keep putting up with me and my schedule, I appreciate, because I do know that my schedule and my time makes it a little bit more frantic on your end sometimes. So I appreciate it.
I wouldn't say frantic. It's just a question of trying to figure it out, you know, but that's fine. That's fine. I take that into account. I always give you a week when I know that we can't record that week anyway for whatever reason, and then it just gives you a little bit more time to try to get it in. So that's fine. You know, we're both professionals, so we know how to figure that out. You know, we deal with it. So minute 71 begins with Blue summing it up, and ends with Blue threatening once again. So let's even start a little before that. What is your history with this movie? Have you ever seen it before?
My history goes about 2 weeks before recording, when I have never seen this movie. I never saw the remake either. I've heard of the remake. I didn't even know who was in the original. So because of this, this is the first time that I've had a movies by minutes assignment where I had to go literally find and watch the movie before I could actually participate.
Okay. So that's good. I'm glad that you have a new first.
It was a first. And I asked the wife if she wanted to watch, and I'm like, you know, it's got Robert Shaw in it, and it was recommended by my buddy. He's doing it. And she's like, you can go watch it. So I did. I watched it.
After having watched it, do you think she should have watched it with you, or she wouldn't have liked it? What do you think?
I think she would have enjoyed it. I think here's the thing I was talking to some folks about, because I actually was recommending it to some other people, because I had, you know, I was like, you know what? I'd never seen this movie before. It's an older movie. If you want to kind of see a heist or a hijack or however you want to call this film, thriller, I said, yeah, it's not as fast paced, and the techniques of, like, if you're used to modern filmmaking, you're going to go, it feels a little slow. But looking back, I really liked it. I love the construction of it. I love the fact that you had another one of those movies where the protagonist and the antagonist never show up in the same scene at the same time, and yet they're supposedly interacting with each other. It felt like a great kind of heist slash hijack movie. And I was very impressed with it. In fact, I think I texted you and said, I almost feel like this is the granddaddy of all the films that you and I have talked about, and some of our favorite films from the 80s and 90s. Like, you can trace it back to this film.
Yeah, of course. I mean, especially Reservoir Dogs, you know, with the colors and stuff like that. You know, fact that Tarantino used the idea of the colors here, you know, is already says something about what he thinks of this type of movie, you know. So that's good.
And then
too.
I texted you and I said, if he didn't get inspiration, it'd be hard not to believe, but Alan Rickman's character in Die Hard, I could trace it all the way back to Mr. Blue with Robert Shaw, because it was so educated and polite and formal. And yet when he was ready to tell you how dastardly and cold he was, you felt it. And I was like, right. Gosh, this was, you could almost say that if Alan Rickman hadn't, it's amazing how they parallel, because that's all I kept thinking the whole time, especially when Robert Shaw would go, ladies and gentlemen. And I was like, oh, that's just like Alan Rickman when he's talking to other people. Ladies and gentlemen. I
because
loved
of the greed
it.
Of the Dr. Tony plan. Because of the greed of the Nakatomi Corporation. They're about to be taught a lesson.
It's that sense of the British being the bad guy, and it's something about just this sounding so smart and having thought of everything and in charge the whole time. You just never sensed that Robert Shaw was not pulling all the strings. It felt really cool. I really enjoyed his performance.
Wow, that is so cool. I'm so glad that you enjoyed it. And I mean, were you able to guess what was going to be happening? Because again, I can't relive the experience of watching it for the first time by myself. I can obviously try and relive it through you.
So having seen so many hijack and heist movies, I figured that they were going, I already knew because I knew some of the actors that they were all wearing fake mustaches, but the fake mustaches looked really good. I figured out what they were going to do as far as like get off at a stop and change clothes, but the whole green light, the whole sending the car on a careening and getting everybody to be worried about it to try to give them the cover to get away, the cat and mouse game, and then the whole thing on the radio with Walter Matthau. I honestly, I don't have a deep bench with Walter Matthau movies, so this was nice to see him in a non-comedy role, even though he had some comic relief, but it wasn't like he was doing it for comedy, if right. That makes sense.
Yeah, of course. I've talked about that many times over the last 70 episodes about the fact that, in order to try and lessen the intenseness of some of the things that are going on here, so we get all those moments. Well, we'll even have a few this week where, you know, he just breaks the ice with a little comic line here or there, you know, which you mm-hmm. chuckle to and you're like, okay, and then you just move on. And, you know, things aren't as heavy and deep as they just were right before that line, you know, that type of thing. So I like the way that that he fits in there, because I saw this movie 40 years ago, but to me, Walter Matthau is always, you know, the comedian. Mm-hmm. So to even, you know, even after having seen this movie so many times, to rewatch it and still see him, you know, as this police officer, you know, so the fact that he's throwing out one-liners here and there is still within his purview, I guess you could say. You know,
I think you'll get to it at the end of the film. There was the one moment where you go, that's the Walter Matthau kind of mugging to camera. You get
right, of course.
Yeah. But other than that, for me watching this, I was struck by two things. Three, obviously Robert Shaw being the consummate villain, but I was like, oh my God, did it start with this movie? Like, how far back do we go? Do we get the archetype? The British accented guy has to be the bad guy. I mean, they make fun of it in the opening of Deadpool in the credits, right? They say, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that we've got to have the British guy is going to be the bad guy, right? Like they just call him that, right?
Right.
So I was struck by that as being, wow, it went back to 1974. I was struck by Walter Matthau doing a more serious role, and even though he could give out one-liners, the one-liners weren't delivered for comedy. We just laughed because of the frustration or trying to release the tension. But the third thing is the fact it felt so improv in so many places, like all the dialogue going on, all the things, all the operators, the people on the car. You just wonder how much of that was all improv versus lines, because it felt real because there was so much just real dialogue being just overlapped and kind of bantered.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. That's one of the problems with when you do a movie minute by minute, you don't, especially one that's, you know, from 51 years ago, you can't really get all the information as to what really happened, you know, how much of it was improv and how much of it was part of this, you know, was set beforehand and stuff like that. So, you know, you go with the flow. Mm-hmm. And again, it feels very realistic from that perspective.
It does. Now, I will say I smiled a few times. Obviously, in the early 70s, the idea of women entering the workforce, women being cops. I mean, there was definitely that sense of the male-dominated fields thinking, oh, my God, these women are coming in. But it never went too over the top for me anyway, right. Watching it. I just thought I chuckled at some of those lines. I chuckled at some of the, you know, they knew there was a cop on board, but what if it's a female? We don't know if it's a male or a female, which keeps us guessing which one of the passengers is a cop.
Right.
And, you know, the people working for the transit authority and the people working behind the scenes. And so that gives you the sense of that era, which I also liked. It gave me a feel of the early 70s. It was very much rooted in contemporary time of that day.
Exactly. Now, were you able to guess who the undercover cop was?
No, not at all.
Okay. My favorite line about the undercover cop is the fact that at the end, you know, when Garber is you know, telling the cop that you know, pretty soon an ambulance is on the way or something like that, and he says you'll be fine, ma'am, you know, yep. Assuming that it's a woman because of the long hair. that the hippie
because he was a long hair hippie undercover. Yep, that was so funny when he was like, "Okay, ma'am, don't worry about it. We'll, the ambulance will be here."
Exactly. All right. Well, I am so glad that you enjoyed this movie. That makes me happy. It means that I didn't waste an hour and 45 minutes of your time. Yeah.
No, in fact, I've even told people, I said, no, it's not going to be as fast. It's not going to be as, you know, if you're interested in the hyper cuts of today, but that's not why you watch it. You watch it because it sets the groundwork for, I think, every one of these kind of hijack thrillers to follow.
Correct. I agree. All right. So as the minute begins, I mean, we ended on Friday with Mr. Green basically saying, I think I'm going to die today. Which, you know, I mentioned about it on Friday that it's pretty ironic that he's the one who says that line, because he's the one of the three that actually, one of the four that actually survives.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to say that he's, you know, I feel like I'm going to die. And then, you know, Blue responds at the beginning of this minute by saying, well, either you live or you die. Which, mm-hmm. you know, as knowing that Blue is basically this gun for hire, you know, that type of thing. So he knows that's the stake of what he's doing. You know, either you're going to live or die. You know, hopefully mm-hmm. you live and you get your money. And if you die, you don't have to worry about it anymore. That's the soldier of fortune idea, I guess, from that perspective. And then the shot changes and we see Gray and Brown loading up with the money. They're just mm-hmm. putting it into their pockets and stuff like that. Mr. Gray is really happy. You see him, you know, throwing kisses, basically. And then Gray says, all right, that's 18 packs each, right? And then the response from Brown is, right. So, you know, that also tells us there are 72 packs of money. But of cash, exactly. Now, one of the things that they never really mention when they're putting the money together here, you know, when they're all loading up, what's to stop Gray from taking 18 packs that all have hundreds on them, as opposed to taking, you know, nine with 50s and nine with hundreds?
And and this is where you need to tell me, because you obviously have done the research. I only watched it once, and I didn't go back and rewatch those minutes. I thought all the stacks were meant to be identical stacks, a mix of hundreds and 20s. Were they separate stacks? Because I thought they wanted to stack hundreds and 20s together.
No, they had hundreds.
They were all the 50s. Same.
There were hundreds and 50s.
Hundreds and 50s. But,
hundreds. But, you have stacks of hundreds and stacks of 50s.
I swear I thought they said that you wanted them to double stack the hundreds and 50s together.
No. He wanted to use double elastic bands.
Right. I guess, you know what? In my head, I just assumed they were identical stacks, that they were all identical, that they had a mix of hundreds and 50s in each stack.
Right. Well, I mean, we see it in today's minute also, but we also saw it last on Friday in the minute where you see that there's some of the stacks have a 50 on top and some have 100 on top. You know, so.
But if it was half of one and half the other, depending which side's up.
No, it's not. It's you know, half of the seven. There's 36 stacks of 50s and 36 stacks of 100s. So, you know, the possibility that Gray is then going to take 18 packs of 100s, you know, that then, you know, Blue or Green or even Brown are going to be getting, you know, less. They're going to be getting half the amount of money to walk away with.
If that's the case, that's a flaw script wise, because I thought they were all identical stacks, which would then make sense that you just grab 18. But if they're different denominations in the stacks, then I don't know how you trust your fellow, especially at this point in the movie where they're already starting to breed some distrust.
Correct. That definitely goes without saying that's what basically is happening. These guys are not trusting one another at all from that perspective. But okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you a question that I have asked every one of my guests up until now. Based obviously on only having seen this once, who do you think is the mastermind behind this whole idea? Do you think it's Blue, or do you think that there is some guy, I'm going to bring up the Reservoir Dogs reference once again. There's someone like Joe who has put them all together.
You know, the way. Again, I only watched it once, and I just watched it a couple of weeks before our recording. I just assumed Robert Shaw was the brain trust behind this, that he must have had a conversation with the guy that got fired, who was just talking about all the things that you could do. And I think it's almost like he could take that information and use it and then pull in the other hired guns that he needed to pull off this hijack.
Okay, well, I agree from a certain perspective, but part of my problem is that we know that he's not happy with Gray, and you'd think that he would have done a little bit a better job trying to find someone to be on.
More trustworthy? No, it's a good point. It's a good point to think about. Why did he go with the guy who's now this loose cannon that he doesn't know he can control? And you're already in the middle of the situation. You would have thought he would have wanted to vet everybody to the degree that he would be in charge of every personality.
Exactly,
I don't know.
which is why I am of the opinion, and again, it's pure speculation because there's no way of me ever knowing the truth about this. That there's somebody like a Joe who put them all together, and therefore it wasn't Blue who has chosen for him to work with Gray. There's someone above who has now put them all together.
The only problem with that is then where's the extra money for the person who's coordinating? Because they're all walking away with 18 stacks of individual to be equal, an equal draw.
No, but they're walking away with 18 stacks to carry with them. That doesn't necessarily
Right.
mean that it's 18 stacks for each of them to take home.
It seems implied in the movie, but you're right. They don't necessarily, because don't they say he's not going to need his share when the one guy gets whacked later, and so they take the money off of him?
Yes, they say he won't need his share, but that doesn't necessarily mean that. It's not being, maybe it's being split up between five.
Interesting. I will say you've given me something to think about, because I mean, you could argue maybe the reason why it falls apart is because Robert Shaw, who's used to being the ringleader, was hired to be the in charge, if you will, but he wasn't necessarily the one who came up with this. Maybe you're right. There is a fifth, a person on the outside. I don't know. I just assumed it was Mr. Blue.
Right, again, I don't know the answer to this either. This is pure speculation, but I just, because of the dynamics between the characters, you'd think that based on what we know of Mr. Blue, he would have done a little more due diligence before trying to decide who's going to be doing this with him. Because you get the impression that obviously he's okay with Green, and you also get the impression that he has some sort of history with Brown. But we know that he does not like Gray.
Right.
That goes without saying. So, but again, though, there's something that we'll never 100% know
Right.
about that. I just like thinking about that aspect of it because it just
I know it's
helps make things a little more fun.
definitely food for thought, because until you had said it, I hadn't really thought about it. I mean, because it's entirely possible that Robert Shaw's character, Mr. Blue, knew that Mr. Gray, ex-mafia, somebody that could be a gun, but maybe he took a chance on this guy because it was the only person that was available that could do what he needed, just have muscle.
Okay, now just to go back and read to you the dialogue about how the money was split up from the Fed. So the money is to be paid in the following denominations: $500,000 in 50s, $500,000 in hundreds, which will be put in stacks of 200 bills each, bound with two thick elastic bands. Okay,
Okay.
and that's all he says. And he says all the bills will be old bills. The serial numbers to be random. That's all. So he doesn't say, he actually doesn't even say how he wants them to be, whether they can be. Maybe you're right. Maybe they could be put together. No. He wants them separate. He wants. There's no way that they can think that he wants to mix and match them here. because that leaves too much open for them to fool them, just to put 100 on top and then the rest all 50s for all 72 stacks.
Well, I'm assuming that the people that are deciding to pay the ransom would know that they would look at all of these stacks of bills and going to flick through them.
Well, they never do.
Well, they may not, but I'm assuming that once you decide you're paying your ransom, you're not going to try to trick them. It wasn't that never occurred to me that they weren't going to pay them the proper amount so that they would hide, you know, fake bills or $1 bills with hundreds on the outside. It never occurred to me once they decided to pay the ransom.
Right. Okay. Again, but my interpretation is that they have stacks of 50s and stacks of 100s. Yeah, they're separate.
No, I mean, this is one of those things where, you know, this is me, a flaw. I'm in my head, I filled in, oh, they're all identical stacks. He wanted a mixed of 100s and 50s. But you're right. He doesn't say stack the two together and band them together. He just says stacks of 100s and stacks of 50s, 500,000 of one, 500,000 of the other.
Right.
I don't know why in my head I just assumed that it'd be a mix of 50s and 100s for each then combined stack. But that's just my brain filling in something that wasn't necessarily said in the script.
Right. Again, my problem with that theory is that it would just add too much chaos to the whole thing. Because, you know, Blue is very meticulous here. Mm-hmm. You know, to go back to your Hans Gruber thing, Hans Gruber wouldn't have said, I want, you know, 500,000 and 50s and 500,000 hundreds and just mix and match. I don't care, you know, how you put them together, because that's what they're counting them. You know, we saw them using the counting machines of making sure that all the money and recounting and making sure that everything is done properly. So you can't put in a counting machine hundreds and fifties together in order to count it properly. You need to do those separately. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
So, did you ever go back and do the math to find out if that would work evenly?
Yes, of course.
If you said 500,000 in 50s, and you're going to have, what, 64? If there's 18 stacks per person, there's four people, that'd be 64 stacks. That doesn't work out. One's going to be short.
First of all, it's 72 stacks. It's not 64.
It's 72 stacks?
18 times 4? 9 times 8? 72.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
72, but you do bring up a point that I didn't think about. The stacks, there's going to be twice as many stacks of 50. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's not going to be exactly. Yeah, that you're right. It's still not
an even number.
It's not 36 and 36. It can't be. You know, from that perspective. I have to try. I'm not a math person, so I'd have to try and figure that one out.
If you take 500,000 divided by a $50 bill, that means you have 10,000 $50 bills. And then if you divide that by 72, you get 138.8 something. So there's not an even number to divide that 500,000 by $50 bills into even stacks. One's going to have to be short.
Correct. No, with again, which means that it's not split up in 72. It's you know, the numbers are going to be different. I'll try and figure out the math on that one. But how many? Let's see. If you have, because he doesn't state how many bills he wants on each, you know, in each stack.
If you same thing when you do the math, it doesn't. Let's put it this way: neither the number 500,000 in $100 bills and $500,000 in $50 bills doesn't divide evenly into 72 stack, like, or having it'd be 18 stacks. So if you have 72 total stacks, it's not going to work. If the numbers that they're saying in the script are right. Now, you heard them say, you know, 18 a piece, that would mean 72 total stacks, but is it 18 a piece? That's what they say.
That's what they say. But again, we don't know how many are in each stack. That's the thing they're not telling us. You know, because he doesn't say, I want, I don't know, you know, $10,000 in each stack. That he doesn't talk about. I mean, I've talked in the past about how much it weighs to have to carry you know, 15,000 bills, you know, five thousand of $100 bills and 10,000 $50 bills. So it's basically it's trying to figure out if you have 72 stacks, so it's trying to figure out how many, you know, how you would break down the 72 stacks evenly. And I'm sure that there are people, you know, listening to this right now that know math really well and are just saying to themselves, well, what you guys are such idiots. You just do this way and that way and you can figure it out. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's supposed to be a third and two thirds. Maybe that's the way that that you would do that. Like if you were to.
I don't know. I do know that
24, I did a quick. 24, let's say it's 24. Okay, so it's 24 and then 48. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah, that makes sense. So maybe it's 24 stacks of hundreds and 48 stacks of 50s, which comes out to 72 stacks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so maybe that's what it is. But the question then is, okay, if you have 500,000 and then you divide that by 24, will that come out evenly? No, it doesn't come out evenly. It's 20,833.
No, it needs to be divisible by 5 or 10 or 2 to become even.
Well, again, I don't think 51 years ago anyone thought that we would actually try to figure out the
probably
math.
Not. weight-wise, shouldn't be a problem. I just did a quick calculation using Grok. If you look at the weight of a typical dollar bill, or in this case, it doesn't matter if it's a $50 bill, they weigh the same. It should be about 22 pounds, so that's 5.5 pounds of just the one of the heavier stack, because you need more 50s than you need hundreds.
Right.
And so it'd be about 7 pounds, almost 8 pounds per person in terms of the how much they're loading in cash.
Right. Exactly.
Which isn't too bad.
No.
Actually, when you're looking at it, of course, back then, $1 million split four ways, that's $250,000 in early 70s. That's not a bad chunk of money.
No, not at all. Considering the fact that we know that in today's world, so $1 million from back then is worth, I think, $6.5 million. So that's still a nice amount to split four ways, or more, depending on if there's a Joe or anyone like that. So who knows? And then Blue decides to contact Garber, and he goes, "This is Palm 123. Do you read me, Garber?" And then Garber responds, and he goes, "This is Garber. Go ahead. He goes, I'm going to give you three specific instructions. Each one is to be followed precisely. Is that clear?" And he goes, "So far," which is a great line. Meaning you haven't just said anything yet, but so far what you've said is clear. And he goes, "Okay. One, at the end of this conversation, you will restore power to the entire section. All right, restore power. Go ahead. Two, you will clear the local track all the way from the 20th Street to South Ferry. By clear, I mean switches properly set, all signals green. I emphasize green, Garber. If I so much as see a red light, let alone get tripped by one, I'll shoot another hostage." And what's really funny is as he's speaking, they keep showing us the hostages. You know, and he's in the cab, so can they hear what he's saying? Are they hearing his threats, that he's basically threatening he's going to kill them? You know, kill another one, which, you know, we know that Blue can be cold-hearted, but I don't think his goal here is to kill the people. His goal is to get the money and move on. You know, he, as we know, he's willing to kill if necessary, which he has done when he killed when he killed you know, the conductor.
Mm-hmm.
But besides that. You know, I don't. He's not Mr. Gray. Mr. Gray definitely wants blood. Blue, I think, right, just wants to, you know, he wants to show that he's willing to do it if needed. But I mean, even with you know, as I referred to them, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, you know, he let them go and said, go back home to your families. You know, the two guys who delivered the money. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not out for blood here. You know, as far as he's concerned. You know, you don't bother me. You nothing's going to happen to you. So, yep. You know, from that perspective, he's showing he means business, I guess you could say.
Right. And I think what we get across from him is somebody who is willing to do what is necessary, but if it's not necessary, he's not going to do it. Whereas Mr. Right. Gray, you'd be like, oh, I just want to whack people for the fun of it, you know, just to show you I can do it. Mr. Blue's not that way. Plus, I think he also, I think Blue plays the long game. Why shoot the cops who are delivering? I don't need the cops mad at me. I want everyone working cooperatively. It makes no sense to shoot them. Whereas Gray, had he been in charge, he probably would have said, now that you delivered the money, we're going to shoot you.
Right. Exactly. That wouldn't have gone over too well.
No, I don't think so. I think, and I love that. It feels like, again, Robert Shaw's the gravitas, his acting, his performance, the camera moves, especially the way the camera moves in on him from outside the window. You get the sense that he's in charge. But mm-hmm. as somebody who's in charge, he's not just flying by the seat of his pants. He's thought this and is sticking to the plan.
Completely. Completely. He knows everything that he's planning on doing here. And I like the fact that when he's giving over some of the information, we see that he like takes a little swig of something that, mm-hmm. you know, and this is the first time that you see him relying, I guess, on alcohol for what he's needs to do, which is interesting. And I just want to point out once again that, you know, in some of the shots where we see Garber, we can see the clock behind him, and the continuity is amazing here. They keep getting the time right. It's like 3:25 at this point. So I've been so impressed throughout this entire movie that the clock is always right in the background behind.
And you know how hard that is? It's especially when you're looking at analog clocks.
That's right. Yeah.
I would have to imagine that on the set there was somebody who was, that was their job.
Oh, we talked about it. There's a woman that's her job, and she also did, was it Planes, Trains, and Automobiles? She has like a really long list of stuff, and I've thanked her for the work that she's done here, because it's just so amazing, because most movies just avoid clocks for that very reason.
Right. Right. I shot a short once upon a time. It was only like a 30-minute short, and that was the thing that was driving us nuts. It's like, oh, we forgot to set the clock back to the right time.
Right, exactly. That's something you always need to keep in mind. And as Blue continues his threats, we end this minute. So is there anything else you wanted to discuss about this minute, Alan?
No, it's a nice, because we're about two thirds of the way through the film, and this is where, if you're watching it for the first time, you're still trying to ask yourself, how are these instructions part of getting out of this? And of course, your mind goes to, we've come into New York City before. We were on the New Jersey side, so we came into the South Ferry before, and although we walked all the way up to Central Park, we took the subway back to to the South Ferry. So I'm very familiar with the line that goes there. And for them to say that, your first thought goes to where in the movie, maybe they've got a boat or something that they're trying to get away at the ferry. Maybe you don't think yet.
Well, we'll talk about that later this week.
Yeah.
But
I mean,
not there yet.
But I love the fact that you're getting more pieces of their plan. And it feels, again, the whole time they've thought this through. They're not flying by the seat of their pants. They are definitely well thought, well planned. A heist or hijack, however you want to call this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's great the way that they do it. They leave us with so many questions along the way that they do a great job of answering them also. You know, they don't leave us hanging with a lot of the questions,
mm-hmm.
which is great. But they bring up so many as things move along. So. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called the Mathow Monday, where my guests will give their top five Walter Matthau performances. So I know you mentioned at the beginning that you don't have a very deep list of Walter Matthau movies, but I hope you have at least five.
I have five, but that's it. So if anybody's yelling at me like, why didn't you do this? Or why didn't you? Then I didn't see the movie. I only picked the five. And ironically, that's all I had were five movies that I knew for a fact, unless you count the sequel, because I have one in here that there's a sequel, but I didn't want to put the one and then this number two. It doesn't make any sense because it's the same character, just a sequel. But I do have five.
All right.
Shall we go in reverse order, 5-1?
We shall definitely go in reverse order, as we always do.
All right. Number five, the character of Hamilton Bartholomew in the movie Charade. 4, this movie, Lieutenant Garber, The Taking of Pelham 123. Number 3, I have picked the character of Max from Grumpy Old Men, which I loved it when I was younger. And then when you catch it, you go, uh-oh, I'm starting to relate to these guys. So I really liked it. Number two, Coach Morris Buttermaker, the Bad News Bears. And my number one, Walter Matthau performance, a character I've never played. I've played opposite in the play. I've played Felix Unger before, but Oscar from Odd Couple.
Yeah, I can actually see you as Felix Unger.
Yeah, I did it. Unfortunately, my wife would say, based on how I live my life, I'm definitely more Oscar. But in terms of my, I guess, the look I have versus, you know, I'm not a, generally you cast a larger kind of slobbish looking person. I don't dress like a slob and I don't act like a slob, but you look at my office and you're like, Jesus, you got stacks everywhere. I'm like, yeah. So, but yeah. But Oscar from Odd Couple, and obviously, Walter Matthau has a career of working with Jack Lemmon and a lot of, Neil Simon stuff, both plays and then plays turned into film, but those would be my top five.
Okay, that is a great list. Thank you very much for that.
Sure.
All right, and now we will play the daily game of Name That Remake, where I will randomly spin a wheel and see what movie remake you're gonna have to try and guess when I give you the years that the movie, the original, came out and the remake, and I'll give you a brief synopsis and you have to try and guess what movie we're talking about. Okay. So let's spin the wheel. See what we get.
Spin the wheel.
Around and around and around the wheel goes.
You're going to insert the sound of a...
I don't need to insert it. Everyone here hears it. Okay. Here we go. This movie, the original came out in 1950, and the remake came out in 1991. There was also another remake in, I think, 2023, but... I don't count that as a part of it. And the brief synopsis is, a father must deal with the fact that his little girl isn't so little anymore.
Father of the Bride?
Yes. Excellent.
Yes.
Very good.
And I'm trying to
Very
remember, good. I know Steve Martin was in the 90s, but wasn't it...
that's right.
Oh, what's his name? Was it the actor that was in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Yes. Spencer Tracy.
Spencer Tracy, yes. Yeah. In the original.
Spencer Tracy was in the original. Yes, exactly. And there was a recent remake from just a few years ago with Andy Garcia.
Mm.
Which was okay. It wasn't as good. It's from 2022 with Andy Garcia and Gloria Estefan. They played the parents.
Okay.
But I still like the Steve Martin, Diane Keaton one. All right. So, Alan, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
Sure. Now, I don't do – we did a Movies by Minutes, me and my buddy, Once Upon a Time, if you want to look at, for the Wilder Ride minute about Gene Wilder. But for me, I am a news talk person. I do radio and comment on what's going on at the national level. If you are interested in a news talk format show talking about current events, you can find The Alan Sanders Show wherever you find great podcasts.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movearoundminute@moveyourob.net. So, until tomorrow,
achoo! Gesundheit.